This is GamesAtWork.biz with Phaedra Boinodiris, Michael Martin, and Michael Rowe, your weekly podcast about gaming technology and play. The thoughts and opinions on this podcast are those of the hosts and guests alone, and not the opinions of any organization which we have been, are, or may be affiliated with. This is episode 150, Cyber Dementors. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon. Michael Rowe here on a beautiful Friday. Well, beautiful in the sense that it's raining or about to rain, or it could be dark, or it could be getting colder.
It's still beautiful.
It could be fall, and I like fall. Fall is nice.
Except when
really excited for an exciting show with my wonderful co-host, Michael Martin.
Hooray. I'm happy to see that it's fall, too, because it was summer yesterday.
Yeah, which is wrong. So wrong.
Which is wrong for October.
Yep, we've got a soccer match to go to this weekend, and I'm looking forward to be bundled up watching people run around freezing.
I don't think that's going to happen.
No, it's supposed to be high in the like low to mid 60s, I think, though. So it'll be nice fall.
Beautiful
weather.
Temperatures, exactly. North Carolina fall, you just can't beat it.
Yep. Anyway, so we have an exciting show of kind of some interesting links that we found this week in our feed. I think. You might consider the title of our show and think about all the crazy, crazy things that could happen if we don't focus correctly on security. And the first thing I want to hit on is a link that we found on TechCrunch about swarms of tiny, cute robots. And first, let's describe what we see here. So this is a group of researchers at the Association of Computing Machinery, or ACM, conference earlier this week, showcasing a small group of devices that are little robots with wheels, a touch sensor, a gyro, and a optical sensor so that they can kind of position with patterns. And the idea is these devices exhibit swarm behavior in order to move things around on a desk, right? And I think we've seen over the last couple of years, we saw quadricopters doing dancing and swarming behavior that way. There are books like Kill Decision by Daniel Suarez talking about swarm behavior. And what I found really interesting about this one is just the way that they're learning from the visual sensors. So the optical sensors are being used to drive swarm behavior around computer tracking, right? And so that way you can dynamically reprogram and rematerialize these devices in real time. One of the examples they show is things like using sensors to sort things, right? Things versus stuff. Another one is how do you group things, right? So you make an interaction motion, which then causes the sensors on these little robots to group into various patterns of sensing many-to-many relationships, etc. And so all different ways that you can take and explore the swarm-type behavior of small robotic devices to create new, interesting, and useful things. What did you think about this one?
Well, I immediately leapt to Kill Decision, too, because that is, for me, a real interesting use case for swarm technology, basing off of insect behavior methods of achieving something that the individual insect cannot, but the swarm absolutely can. So the example here for the OCD kind of person who wants their desk tidied up by having robots moving things around to get the desk cleaned up was also a little appealing to me too. and could be something that would be really intriguing for inventory management or for distribution centers and for things like that, that an individual robot might not be the best way to solve for, or might be a little too expensive to have a robot big enough to move a big piece of machinery or a box or whatever, but you could with a lot of smaller robots that work together. Yeah. I also like the idea, the third piece was, I like the idea of a three-dimensional object essentially materializing for you that consists of small objects to do something different. It wasn't actually something that was in the little video or necessarily in the one chart in there, but you could imagine where if you needed, a pointing stick or something like that, that the objects could connect together, magnetically hold together, and now you've got a fishing rod, whereas before you had just a bunch of little small robots, and those could anticipate your needs and provide for you what you need as you need it. So well,
I can
really
imagine,
clever.
You know, they use biological swarms for things like oil slick cleanups. I can imagine using robotic swarms in a similar way for like discovering people in a collapsed building. I know we have things like roach size robots that are independent that will look for somebody. But if you had a swarm, you could cover the entire building very quickly and identify in a much faster way where the first responders should focus their recovery actions to identify where people are. I can imagine all kinds of use cases where a large amount of data needs to be consumed or constructed very quickly. The company Parrot has fixed wing drones that are used for highly accurate mapping of landscapes, and I can imagine taking a swarm of those and just throwing up in the air, and as long as they recognize the relative position with other drones in the space, being able to do a highly detailed map of a potential real estate area or a mining site or a mountain range for setting up a new ski run for the Olympics. You know, all kinds of crazy examples like this where you need highly accurate, very quickly mapped out sets of data that you can catch with these types of sensors.
Right. And it also reminds me, too, of if you're going almost to the microscopic level, that a swarm could materialize essentially out of thin air to do something for you as well. You know, for a police officer, a swarm might sense a approaching bullet and form a shield out of these microscopic, you know, nanobots to prevent that bullet from hitting the officer. So lots of really interesting concepts that we're really just here at the beginning of.
Yeah, the example you just gave reminds me a lot of the Wonder Twins cartoon, where they would do shape of a so-and-so, form of an elephant.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember some of the books that had this.
Green Lantern did the same thing, right? Green Lantern, he had his ring that would, as long as he could imagine the form, would create that form.
Yeah, well, this is a little bit more not Hall of Justice kind of level, but some of the Young Lady's Primer and things like that, where you would have it was a veil, right? It would kind of like it was interpreted as sort of like a veil that would protect you, would eliminate potential contaminants or disease from getting to you, but could be thought of in a lot of different ways like this too. I have to think about it a little bit more to see if I can remember those books.
Well, speaking of swarms,
yeah.
There's an interesting swarm of robotic devices around Mars right now. And
well, maybe not a lot of.
Was that good? Hey, that was a pretty good transition that I came up with there, right on the fly. And now you ruined it, man.
I'm sorry.
We're doing it again. We're out of here.
Stop. Rewind.
No, seriously. The European Space Agency on Thursday morning of this week, with their ExoMars 2016 mission, had two robots or crafts, if you want to call them that, that were targeted to arrive at Mars, The first one was the Trace Gas Orbiter, and the second one is the, and I'm probably going to pronounce this wrong, Schiaparelli lander?
We'll go with that.
Okay.
we'll go with that.
And the idea, similar to some of NASA's landers, where you park a satellite in orbit, and then you also deploy a lander on Mars, and between the two, you get significantly more science done. And right now, if I don't remember the exact number, but I know there's probably there are currently multiple orbiters around Mars at this point in time. I know that for a fact. The MAVEN mission is one that I was, can I say involved with? I can somewhat say involved with. I donated some money to the Planetary Society that was helping sponsor some of the instruments on the MAVEN mission and got to go see it launch back in 2013. Mars is hard. Mars is a very tough environment to land a spacecraft on, and many different space agencies have failed. NASA has failed. ESA now has failed with their lander. I believe there's been a couple other attempted landers that have failed. But the good news is the Trace Gas Orbiter is successfully orbiting, and they're currently in the process of trying to understand the technical issue that occurred with the lander. So the reason I bring this up is, one, I'm a space geek, and I like it. And two, when you think about how they have to actually land on Mars, right? The atmosphere is a lot thinner than Earth's atmosphere, so you cannot just land with parachutes. What they have to do is they have to sense the environment that they're in as they're coming through the atmosphere. They have a heat shield that drops off. They then deploy a parachute. They sense where their location is in the from a speed perspective. So you have an accelerometer that you're dealing with, just our, like our little swarm robots. And then you also have an altimeter to discover where in the atmosphere you're supposed to be at before they eject a secondary heat shield. And once they get to a certain speed coming into the atmosphere, they will actually drop the parachute and hard land on the surface at a very slow speed, which is considered a soft landing on Mars. Unfortunately, the first two phases went accordingly to plan. So the heat shield, the parachute, but at some point in the final stages, something went wrong, and the lander itself, they believe, fired their thrusters to slow it down, either not long enough or too high in the atmosphere. So at the point where they shut off, it was still going either too fast or was too high. And we don't know the end result other than it is not responding anymore. So it did not apparently land safely on Mars. NASA had this same issue some years back with the Mars Express mission, where the Beagle 2 lander failed to land correctly. But what I'm hoping is that we can get more data from this, and maybe, just maybe, there are things called CubeSats that are going on right now for near-Earth missions, where they're building lots and lots and lots of small, about 10 centimeter by 10 centimeter cubes for deploying things into space. And I can imagine using that same kind of swarm approach to land many, many more landers on a planet like Mars and get data back. So maybe that's something they can do.
Yeah, that does seem a little more swarmy for sure. And you know, what a neat story. I mean, just the logistics, the sheer engineering that it takes to even get to this point is absolutely incredible. So hopefully we're going to hear a little bit more. But boy, what a tough thing. I remember watching the earlier Martian landing solutions where those airbags kind of, you know, deployed and it bounces along for a while and then they deflate and then the little, you know, rover can crawl out of it, and just amazing stuff, really.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's cool. I'm a space nut. Swarming, I think, can help us become more successful over time. But, you know, we had Elon Musk's story recently about getting to Mars, and right now, the earliest it should start happening for humans, I think he said, was like 2025, somewhere around there, maybe 2030. And the starting price is $10 billion with a B per person. And the goal is to get that down into the, I think it was a couple of hundred thousand or maybe $1 million per person.
Uh-huh.
So imagine if you took the same amount of mass that you need and turn that into a whole swarm of sensors, the ability and the science you can do to prep us for the time when we start sending humans to Mars.
Pretty cool. Yeah, and just reading the last little bit of the article here about, you know, what is this trace gas orbiter is really designed to do, and it's designed to pick up some of the trace methane amounts that are on the surface, with the concept that methane is a byproduct of human, or, and well, not human, but living organisms on Earth, and really prepping the way for where and where humans might go to Mars, looking for places where there could be water to be able to generate drinking water, as well as rocket fuel to locate the hydrogen.
Yep.
So very interesting stuff.
Very cool. Very cool. And so, it's going to be a short show today. We have one other link that we want to talk about. And this is kind of, you know, getting to that whole idea of cyber dementors. as we're recording today's show, there's an actual a large-scale attack on the internet going on right now that is having major impacts to sites like Twitter and other sites. And one of the things that I found to be frustrating as I've been looking at security for the last 4 or 5 years is the lack of transparency in when security events occurs and the amount of FUD that is generated by people that I then have to address when, you know, my parents or mother-in-law calls and say, I heard about blah, 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 right? You know, and so the UK government announced, I think it was today even, that they're opening up a new cybersecurity center. And the goal of this thing is to kind of debunk all the scare tactics and actually provide a way of leading by example on how to address cybersecurity. So,
right.
I've been working on a project for the last few months that went live today, which is actually a point of view on cybersecurity as it relates to the Internet of Things. And I'll actually put a link to that paper in the show notes today. But what are your thoughts, Michael? I know this is something that you and I kind of talk about a lot, but I wanted to get your thoughts on this center that they're setting up.
Yeah, well, look, security is crucial for anyone living in the digital era and looking to take advantage of a computer environment for commerce, for collaboration, for communication at all. You need to have some idea about it. And the article references at one point that every attack that makes it into the news has all of those criteria around it and creates fear, uncertainty, and confusion that need to be addressed. We want to make sure that that our parents and our children and our colleagues don't fall into the hole of being so wound up about a zero-day exploit that is not likely to cause them personally a problem, when they should really be focused on a number of things that they can do: strong passwords, good behavior to recognize phishing emails, not using the same password on a multitude of systems. These are things that they can be taking into account and helping to secure their online and digital presence easily. So I think the idea that creating a single center, a one-stop shop, if you will, for all of this in one spot makes an awful lot of sense. And it's a great step that the UK is taking in the creation of their new National Cybersecurity Center.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was watching the Security Now podcast, which I've talked about a couple of times on this show, with Steve mm-hmm. Gibson. And he's done for years now a really good job of explaining security concepts, security issues, mitigation, blah, 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 everything, right? Matter of fact, he was one of the first areas where I learned about Bitcoin back in 2011,
right?
Where I learned about Stuxnet and the analysis of that right as it came on the scene and started showing up. He tends to do really, really good deep dives on security issues to take a lot of the FUD out of them. And in the latest episode, he was talking about something called security fatigue, where we just don't know anymore, right? People get so worried. Everything is broken. Everything's a zero day. All my devices are going to get hacked, right? And so people kind of give up, right? So explaining what's really going on in a way that is meaningful and relevant and appropriate is much more important than the scare tactics that people do on security. One of the things that I find really interesting is, there's been the recent news about the Yahoo hack from a couple of years ago, and the fact that it just came out publicly, which is very, very concerning, because I know I've gotten emails. You know the friend is traveling scam email? Have you gotten that one?
Nope, haven't seen that one. Wait a minute. This is the one where they need immediate access to funds.
Hey, yeah. I'm in Europe right now, and I was just robbed, and my phone was stolen, my wallet was stolen, blah, 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 blah. I need $5,000. Can you email them to me? Right? And thinking back to the couple of those that I've gotten, they've all been from Yahoo accounts. Okay? Mm. And if you think about the interconnectivity of making security easy for people, security and convenience cause challenges against each other, right? So if you used, and I'm using Yahoo in this example because I know I had multiple services attached to that account, like Flickr and Tumblr and a couple other ones, right? The Yahoo account becomes a nexus, that's the word I was looking for, a nexus for attackers to then use to spread additional information. And the longer the nexus is not exposed as being a security problem, the longer they have to take advantage of that. And so with this group, the UK's new cybersecurity center, exposing that when people are hacked, exposing what it really means, what are the linkages, et cetera, becomes critical so that people can react and behave appropriately and address problems. So what I've been doing, one of the things personally I've been doing, is I use a security a password manager.
Right.
It's encrypted with the long passphrase, so a simple dictionary attack won't get it. You'd actually have to have access to one of my machines. You need to spend a couple of decades, I hope, cracking it. And it has a feature where as sites are hacked, it will notify you that your password on that site has not been changed since the hack.
Right.
So all the passwords get flagged. It notifies you if you're using the same password at multiple sites so that you can address isolation of sites. So if you use the same password at multiple sites, if one of those sites is hacked, you can pretty much think that they will, once they know your password, will try it at other sites to see if it works. And so having custom passwords is a heck of a lot of work and a lot of complexity, and it drives us to security fatigue, which was the point of this. So having tools and processes in place to manage that for you is important to reduce that fatigue level, and getting rid of the FUD that occurs with these zero day attacks that they talk about in the article, where people go, oh my God, I should throw away my iPhone because there's a new zero day attack on the iPhone, right? Allows us to get to a point of sanity to address things appropriately. And then you can focus on the areas where you really do need to focus. And one of the things they talk about is in security, and again, back to the, you know, Mars is hard. Security is hard, right? Any hard. Meaningfully complex application will have bugs in it. And more of the things that we create and use are complex things. So we should assume they have bugs, which means we should assume that there is a need for them to continually to be updated to remove those bugs. And so the example that they talk about is buffer overflows. Well, buffer overflows are still prevalent in lots of software defects, and it's one of the key things that's used to be exploited from a security perspective, because if you can overflow the buffer in memory of a working piece of code and get it to run the code that's in that overflow, you can change the behavior of the code. That's it. That's as simple as you can explain it. So understanding buffer overflows is important and fixing them. But if you assume that there's a bug and so you're going to stop using something, you never actually fix the problem. And so I think this is great. I really like it. I know there are lots of different services that will try to help you as an individual, but I think having a government actually stand up and exposing this in a meaningful way and helping reduce the FUD aspect will be very, very important.
Yeah, I agree. And it's not just as simple as buffer overflows, because that's been around forever, right? You know, that's likely one of the big problems that's going on right now across the internet, as you mentioned today. But there's also this concept of the DMARC, which, to be honest with you, I had to go and look up and understand that a little bit better. So the notion of being able to provide a mechanism for email to see that an email is in fact an appropriate email, it's an authenticated email, it's not a super difficult process to implement, but it allows for a degree of confidence so that email that's delivered that purports to be coming from the UK government or from PayPal or from whatever can be reasonably expected to be from one of those environments and not something that's spoofed.
Yep. So it's one of the reasons why I try to encrypt all my email.
Yep.
And use certificates, right? Because if I encrypt it and you get it and it's been tampered with, the encryption breaks.
Yeah. Yeah. Boom. There you go. And DMARC, incidentally, is domain-based message authentication reporting and conformance, which, like I said, I had to learn a little bit about today, and I did.
Ding! Ding! Well, that's, you know, I think that's all the links that we have today. I know I've not had any time to play anything new. Have you got a new game you've been playing lately?
Oh, no. Everything has been, you know... They're very much focused in on the day-to-day stuff, but at least I did remember the cyberpunk novel that I was trying to think of before, and it's called The Diamond Age. Yes. So it's by Neal Stephenson, and this is all about nanotechnology and swarms of nanobots.
Very cool. Very good. I've read a lot of his books. I don't think I've read that one yet.
Oh, no. Really?
I don't think so.
Put it on your list.
Put it on your list.
There you go. Well, Michael, how about you? You said you know you haven't been playing anything either because you've been heads down too, right?
I've been heads down and ill for a couple of days. So
yeah, well, both of those things conspire to preventing games. So
yes,
we need to play some games. And we'll do that.
And by the way, this is episode 150.
Oh, it is, isn't it?
It's 150.
Well, there is one other thing that I think is worth sharing here with our listening audience, and that is you can see me and you can hear me next week because I will be in Charlotte. I'm going to be luckily presenting at the Southern Fried Agile Conference. So if you guys are planning on being in Charlotte, North Carolina, that will be a spot that I'll be, and I'll be talking there a little bit about our Agile experiences here and scaling them and sustaining energy at an enterprise level. So I'm super excited about it. I'll put a link in to our show notes so you can find me as one of the speakers. And if you are in the audience there, please do shake my hand and say hello and that you heard me on Games at Work.biz.
I guess that's it.
I guess that's it.
See ya!
Bye! You've been listening to GamesAtWork.biz, the podcast about gaming technology and play. We are part of the Blueberry Podcasting Network. and would like to thank the band Random Encounters for their song, Big Blue. You can follow us on Twitter at gamesatwork_biz or at our website at gamesatwork.biz.